you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jim Gwynn. I'm here on behalf of Dr. William Schroep. My goal is to save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Dr. Schroep is currently the superintendent of the Patrick County School Division. Ms. Waldron, the plaintiff in the case, was a principal at Stewart Elementary School. Dr. Schroep had determined that he was going to transfer Ms. Waldron from her position as a principal to a central office position, and then later into a teaching position. In the course of doing so, he wrote her a letter that set forth his reasons. They were in bullet points in the letter. He followed through. Ms. Waldron filed suit claiming defamation based on the bullet points. There were a number of different ways that it morphed, but the bottom line was it went to trial on three of the bullet points. At the close of the plaintiff's evidence, the trial court granted our motion to strike and enter summary judgment on two of the bullet points. And the third, the court said, frankly, I should dismiss it, but I won't allow it to go to the jury. The statement that went to the jury was, you failed to ensure that the IEP teams understand the VAAP participation criteria and apply them when considering students for the VAAP. Your actions will result in students being required to take SOL assessments who, under correct interpretation of the criteria, should not have been required to do so. By way of explanation, and you'll probably hear us refer to the acronyms, trying to pronounce them, VAAP is the Virginia Alternative Assessment Program for special education students, sometimes referred to as VAP. SOLs are the standards of learning, and the case went forward. The evidence in the case was from the plaintiff's side that, in fact, the teachers there didn't understand the application of the VAP. And in particular, they didn't understand that there was a 1%, how the 1% cap that the state regulation applied to it actually applied in determining the number of students who were eligible for the VAP.
What about the second part of the statement? Were there, in fact, students who were required to take the SOL assessments when they should not have been required to do that? Was there evidence of that?
There was evidence from Ms. Epperly, Your Honor, who testified that, yes, hypothetically, that would happen. She couldn't say specifically that it happened to any student in the period of time that she'd been applying it, but she did say that, yes, hypothetically, it could happen. And as the trial court noted, that is a predictive type of statement. He isn't saying that's actually happened. He's saying, based on that, it will happen at some point, because what's going to happen is you're going to limit it to 1%, and you know, if that meant that two children were eligible to take it and five should be, that you would have limited those three that weren't, that you didn't allow into the program.
Now, so I'd like to see if I can narrow the issues just a little bit. And so help me out if you will. Do you agree this is defamation per se? That it involves the reputation of the person who was the subject of the statement?
It does. It involves the way in which Ms. Waldron conducted her duties as the principal. So in that vein, yes.
Her employment was terminated as a principal. So,
yes.
Okay. So that. So we're in the defamation per se category. Can we agree? We agree on that.
To the extent that we are hypothetical is that it's defamation at all, Your Honor.
Understood.
Okay. I wouldn't want you to.
I'm going to work back towards that. I know there are points where you don't agree. I just want to. So we're in defamation per se.
If it's defamation at all, yes.
It would be defamation per se. And if it is indeed per se, then we don't need to worry about a defamatory sting.
I would disagree with that.
You believe that the defamatory sting must still be present even if it's defamation per se?
Yes, Your Honor. Because we go from defamation to defamation per se, and you have to have the sting to get the defamation.
Okay. Second of all, if in fact the statements are capable of being proven true or false, it is indeed the jury's responsibility to make that determination. So he said, I should take this away from the jury. But if in fact it is capable of being proven true or false, then the jury determines whether it's true or false.
Yes, but I would submit to the court that in this situation, as a matter of law, the statement was true. And that's what the trial court said, both in the opinion and both at the time of trial.
Again, there's points where obviously you're not going to agree, but I just want to get those out of the way first, if I could. So, okay. You may go ahead.
There were three areas in which legal issues arose or the arguments arose. One was the truth or falsity of the statement. We argued that it was true as a matter of law. The trial judge agreed, but said that he was going to submit it to the jury. Then in his 18-page opinion, he again agreed and said, yes, I know this is that the statement is true based upon the plaintiff's own evidence. Nonetheless, for reasons that were novel, I think, at least as far as being written, decided that he would allow the verdict to stand.
Can we draw the conclusion that the jury didn't agree with that because they found and gave a verdict and obviously thought it was false?
I think that would be the standard approach, Your Honor. That is, jury means what it says, and you look at it that way. It was interesting to me that the trial judge wrote that he thought the jury was mad about something else going on in the school system, and that's why they decided that they were going to rule the way they did.
Well, counsel, I'm not going to state for a second that what the trial judge wrote was appropriate. I believe that what the trial judge wrote was inappropriate. But the question becomes, is essentially that the trial court version of dicta, where we need to look at the facts that were brought out, we need to look at the law, we need to look at our own law with regard to jury verdicts, and what is defamation per se, and that we have to independently determine, separate from the judge's commentary, which I'm not going to pay any attention to at all, what the appropriate, whether there was error or no error. Would you agree with that?
I would, Your Honor, and I would submit that the I would recommend, though, that the court consider looking at the legal argument made by the judge, frankly, because he set out a pretty good brief for the appeal in pointing out why, as a matter of law, the statement was true, why it was opinion, and why that it was, I'm sorry, that why it was opinion.
How could a reasonable jury conclude the qualified privilege even if the allegedly defamatory statements satisfied the Sting test, which I doubt? But even if it did, how could a rational jury conclude in this context that qualified privilege is inapplicable? It's the classic context of qualified privilege.
I don't know. I don't know. I thought, again, that it was the classic case that privilege should have applied as a matter of law. But it was, the judge pointed out in his opinion that maybe he didn't explain it well enough in the instructions. One would think, based upon the court's previous decisions, Great Coastal and the like, that it is a qualified privilege case.
And that would be true even if defamation did not need to be proven for defamation per se.
Right.
Am I wrong or right? Defamation per se simply gives you the additional presumed harm. It doesn't tell you whether it's defamatory or not, whether it's fact or opinion, whether it's true, whether it's false, or any of those standards. It only tells you in this context of your character being allegedly assailed in your profession that there is the jury is capable of presuming harm in the absence of evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, that's my understanding, is that it's a method of, or it is a legal doctrine in which, based upon certain attributes of it, your having committed a crime or something like that, that the jury no longer has to look for evidence of damage, that the damage is presumed. That's the per se nature of it, which is different from Sting, which is the whether or not there is a proprium in the first place. So there's no, you know, there's no authority, nor is any cited by Ms. Waldron with regard to there being some equivalency between Sting and per se. So from that standpoint, we would submit to the court that there is no equivalency, that there is Sting is a different item than per se. And it's very clear from this court's precedent that the determination of whether or not a statement is opinion is a matter, is a question of law that the trial judge is to determine. And in this case, notwithstanding whether or not we're going to rely on the judge's opinion, written opinion, nonetheless, in that written opinion and at trial, he finds, as a matter of law, that it was opinion. And I would submit to the court that having found that it was opinion and then submitting it to the jury was inappropriate and it was error. And as a matter of law, it was opinion, because you can't look at something as complicated and as subjective as these determinations are and then say, well, and I, you know, you haven't had your staff hasn't done this appropriately, and it not be opinion, because all of it is subjective. There is no objective measurement to determine whether or not a student is eligible for VAP as opposed to the SOL.
It would appear that the trial judge agrees with you. It was error.
When they start using terms like I'm virtually going to be reversed by a unanimous court, it would. And I would leave you with the...
He may be wrong about the unanimous part.
You know, as you're reading it, especially as you're an advocate and you're reading through the opinion and you think for the first 16 pages, this is going pretty well. It's going pretty well. And then at the end, you're going, this didn't go well at all. You know, this is different than I thought.
Well, let me ask you this. The expression that Ms. Waldron did not ensure that her IEP teams understood the VAT criteria, isn't that capable of being proven true or false? That whether she did ensure that they understood the VAT criteria or not?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and I think that the trial court's observation in that regard is accurate, which is because this is all subjective, you have to look at all these characteristics that are not objectively measurable, that determining whether or not someone understood in applying those criteria is a subjective matter itself, and thus by being subjective, it would have to be opinion.
So
it couldn't be true, proven true.
Be like me saying one of my law clerks doesn't understand, I don't think, equitable estoppel, and she sues me, or he sues me.
Right.
No, I do understand. And I go, well, I don't agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, how do you prove, there's not a, you know, like law school exams, they're not multiple choice. You know, you write and you put these things out, and that's how you determine.
It's more like equitable distribution than equitable estoppel. I mean, there's just a multi-factor, broad approach under the criteria. In other words, it's even more amorphous than equitable estoppel, it seems like to me.
Right.
Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time?
I would, Your Honor. Right. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Norman Thomas. I represent Mrs. Waldron, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Roger B. Willits. Justice Mims, I'd like to go right to that last question that you asked, if I may. It is provably false. Dr. Shrove's statement is one that is laden with factual content and provably false. Both experts in the case, Mr. Eisenberg and Ms. Davis, testify to the method by which you may determine whether an IEP team correctly understood VAP criteria and appropriately applied that criteria.
Experts testified to this.
Yes.
And they offered expert opinions.
Therefore, Ms. Davis,
it is an opinion. It's not a fact.
Mr. Eisenberg did not undertake the methodology. Ms. Davis did. Ms. Waldron.
But my point is, you hire experts to give opinions. They don't give facts. They're not even competent to give facts unless they review them personally. They are hired for the very purpose of giving an opinion. Isn't it ironic that you would get an expert for an opinion to prove something is factual and not an opinion, which is what defamation law requires?
Well, what the experts did and what Ms. Waldron and her staff did was effectively audit the IEP files. And that's what both of the experts said could be done to determine whether, factually, the IEP teams understood VAP criteria and appropriately applied them.
Do you think whether someone understands something is a verifiable, physical, tangible fact? Going back to my example, if the law clerk sued me and then hired all of you to provide expert opinions on the meaning of equitable estoppel, wouldn't it still be an opinion?
There'd have to be a record developed. And this record is unrefuted that it is provably false, according to Dr. Schroff's expert, according to our expert.
According to his opinion. That's my whole point. It seems like we're missing the obvious. You hire an expert to give an opinion. He gives an opinion that he doesn't agree with us, what the principal said. And the principal says, fine, but I do, and it's an opinion. Therefore, there's no defamation as a matter of law.
Well, what's missing from this example, Your Honor, is the actual empirical work. And that is what was done in this case. Ms. Davis said she looked at over 1,500 pages of material on these students. She looked at the depositions. She looked at the discovery in the case. And that was her determination. And she is an expert. She does IEP work for a living. I will also state
that... She's got a great opinion, but the principal has an opinion too, doesn't he?
Well, that was based on an audit of the actual records. Ms. Waldron went back and audited the IEP records.
That means the expert has a better opinion than the principal. You see, I'm not sure, and I'm communicating. If there's an opinion, and it's not fact, it's not defamation. It can be a lousy opinion. It can be an opinion nowhere near as good as hired experts. It's still an opinion. What's wrong with my reasoning?
Because this is not pure opinion. In fact, our position is it's outright in both sentences a factual statement. But even an opinion that is laden with factual content or facts are implied in the statement that would render the opinion, if they're provably false, it is an actionable statement.
Well, I'm looking at the five criteria for VAAP participation. And they all seem very broad. Does a student demonstrate significant cognitive disabilities? Well, there's lots of room for disagreement there. Does a student have a current IEP? That's factual. Or one that's being developed? Okay, we can figure that out factually. Does a student's present level of performance indicate the need for extensive, direct instruction, et cetera, and so on? All of that seems like maybe the principal was wrong, you know, in his... opinion, we could say, they seem to apply these appropriately, but they're just so broad and amorphous, that's what I struggle with. So then to come in and say, well, it's being done appropriately, when baked into the criteria is all this breadth and subjectivity, how can we say, well, it's laden with factual content?
Well, the complexity of a determination by an IEP team for an individual child does not mean that it's impossible to go back and determine whether the folks on the IEP team understood the VAP criteria and appropriately applied them. They may be able to appropriately apply them and come out either way on a given student very well. But that begs the question of whether they understood the criteria and appropriately applied them through the complex series of factors. And that was the evidence that this record contains without refutation, that it can be done. You can go back and look at the notes, look at the IEP file materials, talk to someone, Ms. Epperle, that was on the IEP team, And from all of that information, you can synthesize out whether or not the IEP team members understood the VAP criteria for purposes of applying.
On brief, your opposing counsel points to Ms. Epperle's testimony that she had a misunderstanding about the 1% cap.
The 1% cap has nothing to do with VAP criteria. The statement had nothing to do with the 1% cap either. But uniformly, the testimony in the record is that the 1% cap has absolutely nothing to do with VAP criteria. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't pertain to his statement. Ms. Epperle also said emphatically and repeatedly that no IEP team utilized the 1% cap in any of the IEP team meetings. Ms. Davis looked at the files and file material. There was no evidence that they did so. Ms. Waldron, Ms. Street, and Ms. Epperle audited the files. There was no evidence that they did so. Now, I want to add this too, and we footnoted this in the brief of the appellee, but the IEP team meetings took place in the spring of 2014. A determination of how many students were referred for VAP can't be done until the following September, when you know the results of all system-wide IEP teams and any IEP team meetings that come in for new enrollees.
Council,
so it would have been impossible for them to apply.
I ask a question? Did you just respond to Justice McCullough's question by saying whether they misunderstood the 1% cap is not part of what we're considering with regard to paragraph 7?
The 1% cap is no part of VAP criteria whatsoever, and the statement did not address it. And all of the testimony in the record, Justice Powell, indicated that no 1% cap was considered or applied by any of the relevant IEP teams.
I still don't quite understand why all you're saying is you could demonstrate that the opinion of the principal was pretty lousy on your best case scenario. But I don't understand why that answers the question. If I were to say, well, counsel's argument in case XYZ, I don't think it was very good. I thought it was actually pretty poor. And all of the people in the room say, well, we disagree. We thought it was great. His statements were accurate. His citations to the joint appendix was accurate. His interpretation of law was accurate. I go, I just disagree. It's my opinion. It wasn't that great. It's whether someone's understanding something, whether your employee is understanding something and training people to understand something, it is inexorably subjective. So I just don't understand why this is not an easy case. I do understand why the trial court judge said there's no liability here. I don't understand why he permitted the verdict to stand. So what is it about, I mean, you keep repeating factual statements, and I keep saying, but the statement by the principal is an opinion. What am I saying that you can unravel to change my thoughts on this subject?
Well, I would begin this way. What I'm saying is in respectful disagreement with Your Honor's position that it is an opinion. And the difference is the record itself. And let me explain that to the court. In your example about whether an employee knows what they're doing, then the opinion about whether that employee knows or was properly trained or understood their duties, go look at how they do their duties. Go look at what they say about their duties, what they do about their duties.
Suppose the opinion's wrong, and the huge majority of people say, I don't agree with his opinion on that. That doesn't make it not an opinion. It makes it a lousy opinion, but not an opinion.
Well, there's the Buffart case that we cited, Shaker versus Buffart, and it talks about the concept of verifiability. And I thought that was a really good word. There's empirical proof, verifiability. That's what we're talking about here. So where is the empirical proof? It is in this record. They said they went back and looked at what the IEP teams did. They looked at the relevant students' files. They talked to someone that was on the IEP team, separately. And uniformly, the results of those that did that work.
The expert testimony?
Well, it was expert testimony, and it was lay testimony, too. Ms. Waldron, Ms. Epperle went back along with Ms. Street and audited each and every one of the files. That provides the evidence of whether they understood the criteria and appropriately applied them.
What about qualified immunity? We haven't spoken about that. Does that not, isn't this the paradigm case for qualified immunity? An employer looks at an employee and says, you know, I just don't think you're doing a good job. Here's why. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right, but someone's got to make the call.
Well, qualified immunity, according to the clear and convincing evidence standard, is a jury issue.
Well, if there's facts to support it, if there's no facts to support it, as this trial judge who sat through the trial said, then it's not a question for the jury. It's a question of law for the court.
Well, then they should have appealed it, first of all, which they didn't.
Appealed what?
They didn't appeal on the issue of qualified immunity. The other thing that I would say about that is qualified immunity can be overcome by malice. And I think I found the one thing that the trial judge agreed on was that the malice that Dr. Schroff acted with respect to Ms. Waldron was palpable across the spectrum of every action he took. And I would submit to the court that to a fare thee well, that was proved by clear and convincing evidence. And if they thought otherwise, they should have appealed it so we could have talked about it upon full briefing in this court.
Well, then is this case really before us because of the emotional reaction to the position that the motive of the decision maker was poor as opposed to the legal principles? Because that seems to be what the trial judge flat out said. And there's no getting around it. That is what he said.
All right. Well, let me say two things. I believe, and I know my colleague in opposition will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he's conceded today that it was defamation per se.
No, I don't think he conceded it was defamation per se. He conceded that if it's defamation, it would qualify as a per se for purposes of presuming harm.
All right, well, let me address that. The definition of defamation, according to the case law of the court, is that which injures one in their reputation.
But
so by
no defamation for an opinion.
Pardon?
There's no defamation for an opinion. I can say I don't think that.
I didn't ask him, is it opinion or fact? I understood. If we were to find that it's defamation, it is in per se category.
Defamation per se was ruled by the trial court. They didn't appeal that. The jury issue on falsity, yes, it is a jury issue as to whether it's true or false. And I understood that Your Honor was working up to the de novo question that's before the court. And, of course, I've spent as much time as I can with members of the court asking questions on that to try to establish that the record shows there was an empirical ability to verify it as true or false. And the work was done to verify it as false. Provably false, which is the de novo question. Is it subject to verification as false? And we believe the record does support that. And the trial court's ruling, notwithstanding it, also said that he was virtually certain, just as he said at trial. I could be wrong. I want to see what a jury does with it. And all of those machinations are irrelevant in a case where the issue is to be reviewed de novo. This is one of those cases that happens so often in the Commonwealth where the trial judge disagrees with a plaintiff's case, disagrees with the verdict, and is as hostile to it as possible, and yet, in the end, does their duty to sustain it when it's based on adequate evidence.
How is the trial judge doing his duty when the trial judge says on the record, as a matter of law, the plaintiff should not recover, it should not have gone to the jury, but I'm going to let the jury decide it because I'm going to put the law aside and allow the emotions of the community to govern? Now, that may be an exaggerated retelling of the story, but that's the gist of it. How is that doing his duty?
May I respond?
Absolutely.
He was wrong, and he went outside of the record to make those conclusions. These were the court's personal views that were expressed with a great deal of vehemence and emphasis. But those views don't matter at all on the issue that's here for de novo review. And we respectfully submit that this trial judge was 100% wrong on any conclusion that these were not factual statements that were subject to verifiability.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
All right, rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would refer you to page 180 of the appendix where Ms. Epperly, who was the lead special education teacher at Stewart Elementary, was asked, did you have a misunderstanding about the 1% cap? And her answer was, about the 1%, I did. And then the question was, and that's the criteria for VAB, isn't it? She said, right. So there's no question that the plaintiff's own evidence showed that the statement was true.
Okay. If it's opinion, if it gets to the jury, plaintiff's own evidence shows the statement is true, can the jury disagree with that? If it's capable of being proven true or false? That was that first question that I asked.
And I guess I would look at, I would accept what Justice Kelsey has said, that it's a trial judge's responsibility not to do that, not to send it to the jury when, as a matter of law, the truth of the statement has been proven. And also, with it being an opinion, it is his responsibility.
Your argument that it's not, that it's an opinion?
Both.
Your argument is that it's an opinion, but now you come back before us and say, oh, but it's true. Well,
some opinions are, Your Honor. I mean, you know, some opinions are true and some aren't.
Some of ours, I take it.
Yeah.
Present company excluded.
50% of the people who come before us would agree with that.
Yes.
But if it's capable of being proven true or false, it's not an opinion.
This is an and/or situation.
You're saying it is an opinion and it's capable of being proven true or false?
What I'm saying is, if it is not an opinion, it's capable of being true. It is true. If you go past opinion and say, no, I find that this is capable of being proven true or false, we proved it true.
You can argue in the alternative.
Exactly. I'm trying to.
I didn't understand you to be doing that at first, but I'll accept that answer.
I apologize if I didn't make that clear, Your Honor. But yes, it appears to me that it progresses. If it's not opinion, you then get to whether or not the statement's true or false.
But isn't that the jury's determination if it's not opinion? That was my first question to you.
It is if there is sufficient evidence. And I would submit to the court that the evidence in this case was that it should not have been submitted to the jury because there was no evidence that the statement was anything other than true. The only evidence put forth by plaintiff's witnesses and plaintiff's experts was, if your belief is that the 1% cap limits the ability to refer these students to VAP, that's a misunderstanding. All the experts agreed.
And that is the substance, that's your opinion of the substance of paragraph 7. Because I'm a little confused. I thought it was the 1%.
It is.
Counsel said it had nothing to do with the 1%. It had to do with the very subjective 5 criteria that you use once you get past the 1%.
Dr. Shrove testified, unrefuted, that he was referring to the 1% cap.
Okay.
That he was concerned that they were limiting the number of children who were eligible for VAP, and as a result, to get right down to it, we were placing kids in a situation where they were never going to pass the SOLs. And he thought it was a humane thing to do.
All right, your time has expired. Call the next case.